All right. Welcome back. Final session, principles for practicing politics. All right, in this final session, I'm going to give you a number of principles, I think, that will kind of help to clear away some of the muddiness of politics. Really, what I've done in this session, unlike the other ones, which kind of had a natural flow to them, this is just a number of different things. Basically, all I'm doing is just responding to moronic things that I've heard. And so I'm just making fun of Christians. So all of these are responding to things that I see online or have heard traditionally that I just think are well-meaning but really unhelpful. So I think there's 10 of them. Number one is that God cares about your politics. There's a strange apathy that I see in some evangelicals toward the topic of politics. I think a lot of it is related to a subtle pietism that reflects, as we talked about, even the Anabaptists, but I think that's bled into the larger evangelical world, this radical separation of church and state that some have advocated, kind of a Gnostic division between the physical world and the spiritual world. We should all be about the spiritual world, but let the world around us crumble. So God cares about your prayers, and God cares about church attendance, and God cares how you raise your kids, but not about how you vote. Not about things like inflation or abortion or immigration or whatever. Now some people would then link, okay, abortions, yeah, in that first category, but taxes or whatever is not. In other words, God cares about these things, but he doesn't care about these other things, how you vote or think about politics. There's a number of problems with that. First, it only works if politics isn't about trying to establish justice, trying to love others, which we've already seen that it inherently is. The minute that you recognize that politics is about justice and love and peace and human flourishing and so forth, you can see the lie behind apathy. Someone says, I'm apathetic about politics. And you're like, okay. But imagine if someone says, I'm apathetic about loving others. You'd be like, well, that's stupid. You see the lie behind it whenever you actually dig below the surface. What is politics essentially? That's why I wanted to start with the first session, which is it's about human flourishing. It's about prosperity. It's about all of these things that we should be about. The minute that you recognize what politics actually is, logically, theologically, biblically, you can see that apathy is not an appropriate response. I get being frustrated by politics. In fact, I think that frustration is exactly how we should feel, as well as righteous anger when injustice and evil are platformed as the law of the land, when we, quote, frame injustice by statute. So frustration and anger are appropriate. Apathy isn't. And second, apathy is inappropriate because it suggests that you can carefully partition off those parts of your life that are sacred from those that are secular. And that introduces a division that's foreign to the biblical worldview. I don't know where exactly that partition comes from. It isn't in the Bible. Look at 1 Corinthians 10:31. So whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. I think voting would fit under the banner of, quote, whatever you do. As has been said, our goal should be all of Christ for all of life. In other words, if you take the lordship of Christ in your life seriously, then you should seek to apply that lordship to every area of your life, to your work, to your self-control, to your parenting, to your marriage, to your leisure, including your participation in politics. So in short, God cares about your politics. He even cares how you vote which is intuitive with even a second thought. After all, no Christian would think it's appropriate to vote for Nero or Hitler or the Antichrist if you knew it was him. And the minute you recognize that it's inappropriate to do that, you're conceding that your political involvement is ethical, it's moral, it's theological, and therefore God speaks to it. So God cares about your politics. Second, politics are neither all nor nothing. It's really easy for us to overreact or underreact to politics. Finding balance is notoriously difficult. Some people, as you've talked about before, idolatrously put all their hopes in politics. And others ignore it completely. They throw out the baby with the bathwater. As we just mentioned, they're apathetic. And here we see where politics is built upon a helpful anthropological analogy. What's anthropology? It's the study of what? Mankind. Anthropos means mankind. Some, in their understanding of anthropology, what or who man is, some are like materialists. They think man is just flesh, just body, just matter. Right? Traditional kind of evolutionary theory, we're just beasts. We're animals. Others, like Gnostics, think that man is just spirit. The goal is to be released from the body because it's a prison. Biblically, man is neither just flesh nor just spirit. We are embodied spirit, or we are ensouled bodies. How does that relate to politics? Well, if man is all flesh, there's no afterlife. This life is of ultimate importance. Therefore, you can see how politics would be everything. All that matters are earthly ends because we are simply material beings. But if, on the other hand, man is just all spirit, this earthly life has no meaning. We're just waiting for that big chariot to heaven. In that case, politics means next to nothing. All that matters are heavenly ends because we're essentially entirely immaterial beings. So the minute that we recognize that we are both flesh and spirit, we can properly understand that politics isn't everything, but neither is it nothing. You've got to keep on your city of man hat while keeping on your city of God hat. Our ultimate hope isn't in our government, but God, who is our ultimate hope, does good through us through this penultimate hope, the secondary end or means. So our ultimate hope isn't our government, but it's with hope and expectation that we pray, your kingdom come and your will be done, even as we seek to work toward that which that will being manifest in the here and now. Third, this is an implication of what we already talked about. Christians have a political responsibility. Now, I'm saying this in the context of our democratic republic. If we lived in North Korea, for example, I don't know exactly how to flesh this out. You'd still have to pray for your leaders and so forth. But we don't live there, so I'm talking about our particular responsibility given our particular context. So what is our responsibility? Well, you have a responsibility to do whatever is in your reasonable power to try to cultivate conditions most conducive to human flourishing. And that can carry a lot of sub-responsibilities. For example, voting. I think in general, Christians should vote. Are there exceptions? Sure. I certainly don't think you're in sin if you happen to be sick that day. You can't make it to the polls. You totally forgot about that local county commissioner runoff election or whatever. In fact, I would say that Christians can at times righteously refrain from voting. But I think that should be for principled reasons and not out of laziness or apathy or ignorance. Do you have to attend every city council meeting and watch every debate and read every single line of the party platform? No, that's why I said do whatever is in your, quote, reasonable power. For us, most of us, it's not reasonable to think that we'd personally run for city council or governor. Some of us may want to do that. If so, great. But each of us have a political responsibility that demands good and proper stewardship, recognizing that the talents he has given to you might differ from those of your neighbor. But all of us have a political responsibility. Discerning what that political responsibility is, it's going to take a lot of prudence, and it's going to take a lot of conversation, a lot of consideration of your individual talents and time and all those kinds of things. Fourth, we cannot divorce the gospel from politics. We've already hit on that a bunch this morning, but it bears repeating. One of the most pernicious errors of a lot of modern evangelical thought is that we promote gospel centrality, but then we kind of reduce the gospel to some lowest common denominator about how you and Jesus become buddies. And we need a much bigger gospel. We need a gospel that speaks about things like reconciling Jew and Gentile, protecting the sanctity of life and marriage, what justice entails, and so forth. In other words, we need a gospel of the kingdom, which should be easy because, after all, the gospel is the kingdom. I agree, we should just talk about Jesus. That's what some Christians say, just talk about Jesus. Don't talk about politics. The problem with that is in talking about Jesus, I have to talk about what he wants. And what he wants to talk about and what he did talk about. And he told me that I am to teach others to obey all that he commanded. Notice the Great Commission isn't go and tell others how to be saved and then never talk about anything else. No, the Great Commission means that we have a mandate from our risen Lord, the King of Kings, to talk about sexuality and money, taxes, and marriage, and divorce, and ethics, and sin, and murder, and self-defense, and lust, and lying, and stealing, and all the other stuff that he talked about, at least by implication. Notice how political all of that is. You can't avoid the political implications of the gospel without distorting the gospel itself. You can't just talk about Jesus without talking about the things that Jesus tells you to talk about. One of the reasons we can't avoid the political implications of the gospel is that the state itself is like a black hole sucking up all issues of ethics and civics and making them political. Right? Whether or not to murder babies, that shouldn't be controversial. That shouldn't be a, quote, political issue in the way that we use that phrase today. We've bought into the lie that that's up for debate. Same is true with LGBTQ issues. Even common sense has been made political these days. That's part of what we need to understand about the state. There is no neutrality because the state is inherently totalitarian. Caesar recognizes no limits except those that are imposed on him from outside of himself. That's why our founding fathers were concerned about tyranny. They were less concerned about Britain or France, or any external enemies. If you read the Declaration of Independence, if you read the Constitution and so forth, they were more concerned about us, internal threats. They were concerned about tyranny. And so they embedded certain principles into our founding documents. Not perfect founding documents, but they embedded into those documents things that they thought would protect against tyranny. Things like the Bill of Rights, the idea of the separation of powers, limited government, federalism rather than nationalism. Obviously, many of those have been eaten away over time, and as our country has moved away from being a moral and religious persons, the Constitution has become somewhat inadequate. But that was the original purpose. So we can't avoid politics because the state has a way of making everything political. Consider the fact, 5 years ago, no one thought that the government would attempt to tell Christians they couldn't meet on Sundays or couldn't sing without masks on. Yet sure enough, a big pandemic comes, and that's exactly what we saw. The government has this ratcheting effect. You know, one of those ratchets, like a tie-down strap or something? And it goes in one direction. You can pull on it, and it ratchets, and it gets tighter. It never goes the other direction, though. The state's like that. That's what totalitarianism is. So yes, the gospel isn't politics, but the gospel is God's holistic redemption and revelation, and that includes political philosophy. So don't buy into the lie that sticking to the gospel or preaching Jesus means that you need to avoid thinking and acting politically. Fifth, we as Christians, we need, if I were to summarize this, we need prudence. We need wisdom. We need to be able to distinguish direct and indirect commands. I read an article this week that's distinguishing straight line biblical commands. This is his language, straight line biblical commands from jagged line commands. I'm using instead the terminology of direct and indirect commands. In general, I mean the same thing. But a direct command is kind of like a nonstop flight. I can go straight from a biblical prescription or prohibition to a modern application. For instance, do not murder means that I can't murder my wife or my kids, even those in utero, or my neighbor or my enemy. Now, the key word there is murder. You've got to define that correctly. All murder is killing. Not all killing is murder. In fact, there are even different Hebrew and Greek words distinguishing murder from killing. That's why the King James Version is a bad translation on the sixth commandment. Thou shalt not kill. It's not actually the command. It's a bad translation. The command isn't not to kill, but to murder. In fact, Ecclesiastes 3 says that there is, as the great John Grisham wrote, a time to kill. Christian tradition in general has said that killing in self-defense or just warfare or capital punishment should be justified killing. That's why it's really strange when you have evangelicals who say that if you oppose abortion, you also have to oppose the death penalty. You might, in a consistent biblical worldview, you might oppose some of the ways that we practice the death penalty in our particular context. You might think sometimes we get it wrong. You might think our system is imperfect. Absolutely. But biblically, you can't oppose it in principle. That's a false equivalence. You can't murder, ever. That's clear. That's a direct command. And sometimes politics involves those direct commands, but other times it's not a direct flight, a nonstop flight. It's a flight, you have to take a stop or two to refuel by adding some other principles, some other theological implications, to get some other texts to make some deductions. For instance, the question of how to get rid of abortion. Right? No Christian should question whether we should get rid of abortion. That's a direct flight. That's a non-stop. That's a non-starter. There is, though, room for debate for Christians to talk about the best means to achieve that end. It's strange to me. There's been such a fierce debate in the evangelical world the past couple of years since Dobbs overturned Roe v. Wade between abolitionists and incrementalists. Abolitionists say abortion should be ended right now in the whole country. Incrementalists say, we can't achieve that right now. Let's take a series of steps so that we can eventually get there. Not to be pragmatists, but to be practical. Now, I get there are certainly some allegedly pro-life incrementalists that don't really care about abortion. A lot of conservatives will say they're pro-life, and then they vote against pro-life measures. They're just courting evangelical votes. I get that. I'm not talking about them. I'm talking about people who genuinely want to end abortion fully. They simply think the best way to do that isn't in one fell swoop, but rather through a series of actions. Or again, ending abortion is a direct application of do not murder, but whether or not you should attend a pro-life march or protest outside an abortion clinic is indirect. You know, if you have a friend who says, I think we should have more abortions, that's something to divide over. That's something to fight over. But don't be the kind of person that says, unless you will go to this march with me or unless you will protest with me, therefore you don't care about the issue. We can have different means to pursue the same end. These are areas that faithful Christians at least should be able to discuss and debate and even disagree. You want to take the Dallas North Tollway to get to Uptown Dallas. I want to take 75. Why do we have to fight? Let's talk it out. Let's debate. That's good. Depending on the traffic, there's probably a better answer. But we can agree to disagree. Don't villainize those who are moving in the same direction but simply going a different route root or speed. In other words, we can agree on biblical ends while still disagreeing on the practical means. I think that the more indirect an application, the more stops on the way where you have to gather other texts, if you will, the more humility we should have, because we're moving out of the realm of direct application and out of knowledge and into the realm of conscience and of prudence. I'm referenced in the notes, the blog where I got that straight versus jagged line imagery. I commend that to you for more on that principle of distinguishing direct and indirect applications in light of prudence. 6, beware the allure of pious-sounding half-truths. We've talked about some of these already before. Jesus wasn't a Republican or a Democrat. Well, of course he wasn't. But imagine saying that during World War II. Jesus wasn't a Nazi or an ally. I guess we don't know which one to support. Or when a police officer shoots a legitimate murderer, some would say, well, Jesus wasn't a murderer or a cop. Oh, so profound. Why are those misleading? Because they're suggesting what's called a false equivalence. Of course, Jesus wasn't a Republican or a Democrat. He wasn't American. Those parties didn't exist. But that doesn't mean that he's equally pleased with them. That doesn't mean that they're morally equivalent. Yes, the British and the Americans had their problems. They weren't perfect in World War II. Nevertheless, they were generally morally superior to the Nazis in the grand scheme of things. The fact that Jesus is an American or German doesn't mean that it's impossible for us to know which side he would have at least preferred. Or take the phrase, God's kingdom isn't of this world. You shouldn't care about politics because God's kingdom isn't of this world. Again, that's true. As the great Inigo Montoya said, I don't think it means what you think it means. Jesus said he wants us to be in, not of the world. He's not taking us out of the world. So yes, his kingdom isn't of this world, but his kingdom is about remaking this world, the restoration of this world, the redemption of this world. He said, quote, behold, I make all things new. The fact that his kingdom isn't of this world doesn't mean that this world doesn't matter. That's Platonic. That's dualistic. That's Gnostic. That's pie-in-the-sky pietism. That's false. Let me give you another silly thing that I've heard. If you really love your neighbor, you will wear a mask or you'll get a vaccine. Or if you really love the sojourners, you can't be in favor of any immigration restrictions whatsoever. Again, this is pietism. This is legalism. It's suggesting that an indirect application is actually the only appropriate application. It's a form of drive-by guilting to coerce you. It's a law masquerading as love. What if masks are relatively ineffective, or at least relatively so? What if the vaccine in question is actually dangerous? I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying, what if? What if mass unrestricted immigration isn't actually good for the country or the immigrants? What if these policies that we say are a way to love our neighbor actually hurt our neighbors? Years ago, I used to do a lot of mission work in Africa. I read a couple of books on the history of colonialism in Africa, and I read some books on the efforts to help modernize the continent. And one of those books was called Dead Aid. The other was called When Helping Hurts. I like the title of that second book. That's what I want you to think about. What if our helping actually hurts? For instance, we send a bunch of food. We just flood the market with food in a particular village. What effect does that have downstream on the farmers? Well, now all of a sudden, they don't have anyone to give their food to. They don't have any means of having a livelihood. So they give up becoming a farmer. They go do something else. And then when the food that we sent runs out, now nobody has the means to be able to grow food, and things get worse. They gave the example of churches putting together a clothes drive. We say, you know, we send 500 t-shirts, and we pat ourselves on the back, and we virtue signal. We've sent some care package to an African village. The kids open it. They're super excited. They finally got that Mavs 2023 NBA champion shirt. Some of you realize the irony of that. Or they got a Michael Jackson Thriller shirt. I've seen some of those over there. One man's trash is another's treasure. So we send all these shirts, and everybody has a couple of shirts. Well, meanwhile, the local seamstress whose living depends on making clothes for the village is suddenly out of a job. She has no other skills. So she's out of work. She has to learn some other means. She has to sell her equipment to get by. And 1 or 2 years from then, when the shirts are outgrown or tattered, the kids need new clothes, there's no one in the village who has the skills or the resources to help. The end result is the village is even worse off, trapped in a cycle of perpetual poverty. Trapped in a cycle of perpetual dependence. By the way, one of the things to note with a lot of these sort of tug on your heart, empathetic, you know, think Sarah McLachlan crying over a commercial, these progressive policies is they cultivate dependence. That's intentional. They want you to be dependent. In fact, they're terrified of your independence. They want you to be dependent because that's part of the totalitarianism. This hypothetical, though, shows that sometimes what might appear loving isn't loving. How do you love the panhandler on the street? Do you give him money or not? Maybe. Or maybe that leads him to overdosing, or it perpetuates an oppressive situation. For example, one time I was in Cambodia. I had a buddy who was born there. He fled the Khmer Rouge, killing fields. He grew up in America, and then he went back there. He got converted in America, and he returned there as a missionary. And I was over there visiting him, and he told me that many of the kids, the street urchins, were begging for money. They actually had a handler. He said, don't give to them, because if you give, you just perpetuate. You put money into the pockets of pimps, basically. Now, I'm saying, in no situation should you ever give? No, of course not. But I'm saying that we shouldn't bind people's conscience or allow our conscience to be bound by these pietistic half-truths. Let me give you another example of this, something that I've heard a lot of times. How many of you have heard the phrase, you can't legislate morality? And again, that sounds profound, that sounds pious. But it's the kind of wisdom that someone comes up with after a couple of drinks. Right, even a few seconds reflection shows how morally, intellectually bankrupt that phrase is. Now, first, as in all error, there is a little bit of truth. What's the truth there? Well, you can't legislate people into the kingdom of God. You can't bind people's conscience by the law. You can't convert people simply with the law. But what's the problem? Well, all law is legislative morality. You can't legislate morality, so therefore we can't say that you can't murder, you can't rape, you can't steal. All of those are examples of legislating morality. As we said earlier, the question isn't whether but which. Which morality, which ethics, which blasphemy laws will be imposed and enforced? Which vision of love or the good life? Not whether but which. So beware half-truths that bind the conscience to unbiblical platitudes. 7. We need to cultivate a taxonomy of political priorities. Y'all remember what a taxonomy is? Probably learned it in middle school or something. It's a way of arranging living organisms. For instance, family, genus, phylum, species, so forth. In theological, political terms, a taxonomy is a way of arranging different beliefs according to their priority. For example, as it relates to theology, everyone has a taxonomy. You have first-order doctrines, things like the Trinity, the hypostatic union, the virgin birth, resurrection of Christ, whatever. They're typically described as the sine qua non, the doctrines which define the boundaries of orthodoxy. Then you have second-order issues like predestination, gender roles, sacraments, etc. They're important, but they're not absolutely essential for salvation. Then there are third-order doctrines like the meaning of the rapture or the millennium in eschatology. That's a theological taxonomy. First order, things we should die for. Second order, things we should fight over. Third order, things we discuss and debate, charitably agree to disagree. So first order distinguishes kind of the the boundaries of the universal church, Christians from unchristians. Second order, kind of our generally boundaries of local churches. Third order might be things the members of the church or elders of a church even might disagree on. What about a political taxonomy? Well, a political taxonomy would be the attempt to arrange political priorities. For instance, poverty and abortion are both bad for kids. It's better for a kid to miss a meal than to be murdered, though. Christians should care about both of them. We should care about poverty and we should care about abortion. But one is much more important than the other. This is important when it comes to the question of single-issue voting. For most evangelicals, the issue of abortion historically has been of such priority. It's been the most decisive factor for the past few decades. It's weighted proportionate to its importance. The importance of the Imago Dei, the sanctity of human life. Yes, taxes and tariffs are important. They affect whether I can take my kids on vacation or how much I have in savings or if or when I can retire or what kind of house I can live in. But whether my kids live or not is more important than how comfortable their life is. Now, how has this taxonomy played out historically? Go back to 1968. Historically Democrat, Alabama Governor George Wallace, he ran as an independent saying this, there's not a dime's worth of difference between the two major parties. Now, that was hyperbole, but there was some truth to it. The main differences at that time were things like economic policy. You may note 1968, that was before Roe v. Wade. Over the next couple of decades, the parties diverged greatly in regards to the question of abortion. And that chasm expanded even more over the past 20 years as one party has added the celebration of LGBTQ, critical race theory, Marxism to their platform. Atlantic journalist Thomas Byrne Edsel writes this, whereas elections once pitted the party of the working class against the party of Wall Street, they now pit voters who believe in a fixed and universal morality against those who see moral issues, especially sexual ones, as elastic and subject to personal choice. This is now the divide. It's not over taxes. It's not over tariffs. It's not over economic policy. Yes, those things still exist, but that's not the main divide. As pastor theologian Daryl Harrison tweeted a couple months back, the Democratic Party has platformed the five D's, death and the cult of abortion, debauchery, the platforming of queer theory, discrimination and policies of DEI and CRT, disorder in the form of unrestricted illegal immigration, and disobedience in the form of rampant crime. So you see here, in the 60s, maybe, the difference. Not a dime's worth of difference between the two parties. There's this massive chasm that opened up. Now, unfortunately, that chasm between the two parties has closed a bit, with at least the current Republican policy caving quite a bit on abortion and marriage. So it's certainly true that no party is a perfect representation of biblical justice and morality, but even so, it's a false equivalence to suggest that they are equivalent. It is true on a number of issues of a lot of significance, extreme biblical significance. On a number of issues, the Republican Party is now negligibly better. But on many issues, it's quite a bit better. And on no matter of moral significance that I know of, is it appreciably worse in regards to actual policy. That leads to the next point. Christians should be aware of the times in which we live. We don't live in the 60s. We don't live in the 80s. 1 Chronicles 12:32 commends of Issachar, men who had understanding of the times and to know what Israel ought to do. One of the great challenges of ministry, and I think just of being a Christian, is the need to not only exegete the scriptures, but also the culture. Why are people talking about heteronormativity and cisgender? Those words wouldn't even have made sense to your grandparents. Now we all understand them. They're part of the zeitgeist. What's happening in the culture? What are its assumptions? What are its presuppositions? What's happening below the surface? Why is everything so racialized today? Why does everyone talk about white privilege? Why does every company have a diversity, equity, and inclusion department? Why is there suddenly such sympathy for Muslims? Such a demonization of the Crusades. Fascinatingly, 100 years ago, Muslims weren't bothered by the Crusades. And now not only are Muslims, but most liberals. I'm not defending the Crusades. I'm just saying it's interesting that 100 years ago, no one was bothered by it. Why do the Palestinians receive more sympathy than the Jews today? Why does this generation of Americans seem to despise America? We've always known that this republic was flawed. Why are its flaws suddenly magnified to such a point that there is open disgust at our traditions and narratives? So we need men and women like the men of Issachar, men of understanding, who knew what time it was and knew what to do. Reminded of the story from the Gospels of the woman who anointed Christ with expensive ointment. In John 12, 4 through 5, it says this, "But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, he who was about to betray him, said, 'Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?'" Now, if you just take him at his word there, that seems admirable. That seems pious. That seems selfless. Very empathetic and compassionate. But look at the next verse. He said this, not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. And having charged the money back, he used to help himself to what was put into it. I think one of the dangers for Christians today is that we're far too naive. We take the Judases of the world at their word. And we have a responsibility to be wise, to see behind the lie. I'm not saying we should be suspicious of everything, conspiratorial. But I do think a bit of skepticism can be helpful to ask the question, does this policy actually help the poor and oppressed? Is this policy actually just? Is this policy actually the best way to apply biblical love to the situation? John 2 says, Jesus didn't entrust himself to the crowds because he knew all people. He knew what was in man. Christians could be served well by understanding not only the times in which we live, but also anthropology, the doctrine of man. That is the doctrine of today. Calvin said, all true wisdom comes from a proper understanding of who God is and who we are. The knowledge of God and the knowledge of man in that order. And according to theologian Carl Truman, anthropology is the doctrine of the day. As much as Trinitarianism was the doctrine of the 4th century, Christology of the 5th, justification of the 16th, just consider how biblical anthropology is under attack today. For instance, when does a person acquire the imago Dei and therefore sanctity and rights? Is that something that comes at conception, at viability, at birth, even later? Are gender and sexuality distinct things? Is there a gender spectrum or is there a binary? Are people basically good or are we depraved? What is marriage? Who should share in that? What is the cultural mandate and the enduring call to work and rest? Are all laborers deserving of their wages or not? Should those who don't work receive pay? Is our identity dependent on our race? How should we think about race and ethnicity? These are anthropological questions. We live in an age where everything the Christian faith or tradition has assumed about mankind is now disputed. Mankind is not a unique creature. We're evolved, or maybe even devolved. Mankind is not binary in regards to gender. Mankind is not heterosexual, but a spectrum of sexualities. Ours is a very anti-biological age, a very anti-creational age, a very anti-fact, anti-truth age. And when you're anti-creational, you're also, by the way, anti-creator. Christians need to see that. We need to know the times in which we live. Yet again, we see we cannot divorce politics from theology as if there is such a thing as a religiously neutral set of political propositions. 9, Voting isn't about personal preferences, but the divine will. So much of what we see in the world is simply voting on the basis of personal interest. So-and-so politician is going to favor my race, or my sexuality, or my profession, so I'll support them, even if they're horrible in general. Just blatant partiality. And Christians might be tempted to feel like we're just doing the same thing. We're voting for a candidate that most aligns with our values. What's the difference? The difference is we aren't voting for our preferences. Rather, we're voting for what has been revealed to us as objective goods. As we started this morning, we talked about the goal of politics. It's the will of the people. W-E-A-L. We don't use that word much today. We see it in the word wealth, which doesn't just refer to riches as we think of money, but riches in the sense of well-being in general. That's why you might see a state such as Virginia referred to as a commonwealth. They have a common vision of what is the wealth of the society. Again, don't think money. Think weal in the sense of well-being, flourishing, goodness. So Virginia was referred to as a commonwealth because it was a society that was united by a common vision, the will, the mortal goods that lead to the flourishing of society. As Christians, we aren't just voting for individual rights, but rather those rights which are inherent to the flourishing of the society. God, our Creator, has said, society best functions in this way. We're voting to accomplish those ends. What is in the best interest of the people as a whole, whether they recognize it or not? As Robert George states, it can be and often is unjust to subject people to powerful temptation to do things that are harmful to them, morally or otherwise, and whether or not they are cognizant of the harm. Now think about that for a second. He says it's unjust to allow for there to be a context in which someone is powerfully tempted to do those things which are actually harmful to them. Sometimes it's unjust to give people choices if those choices are going to hurt them. My child is holding a gun to his head. It's unjust for me to say, I can't stop you. Someone may not see a car barreling towards them. They might not even care. They might have jumped in front of it on purpose, but it's nonetheless loving to do everything in your power to push them out of the way or to stop the car. Me doing what is most loving for my daughter or my son, me doing what has been their best interest, sometimes hurts them in the short term. Sometimes they don't like it. I've never once spanked Larkin or Cannon and heard them say, you know, please, sir, may I have another? So sometimes loving others means you have to act against your own personal preferences and theirs. If that's true for loving your kid, it's true for loving your neighbor. Most of the time, there are some exceptions when it comes to, you know, the route of a highway or something like that. Most of the time, a vote isn't about personal preference. It's about seeking the welfare of the city in which God has placed us. Bovink says this, all laws and rights, whatever they may be, have their ultimate ground not in a social contract, not in self-existent natural law or in history, but in the will of God. Viewed not as absolute dominion, in other words, God is not capricious in his laws, but as a will of goodness and grace. God's grace is the fountainhead of all laws and rights. Last one, most spicy. We can never vote for the greater of two evils. Here's the deal. I can't stand up here and tell you in my role as a pastor who to vote for. That would violate IRS laws. Not sure I necessarily agree with those laws, but oh well. I can't tell you who to vote for, but as the gospel says, let the reader understand. I think Christians have a few options. I think it's possible to refrain from voting, as I mentioned earlier, not out of apathy, not out of laziness, but as a principled response to the options. I don't think that's the best option, but it is a legitimate Christian option. Another option is to write in a third party. Are either of those the most wise? I don't think they're sinful, but are they wise? And by the way, I think we should aspire to be wise, to be strategic. to be, dare I say, political. After all, Christ tells us to be innocent as doves and what? Wise as serpents. I've seen a lot of Christians who want to be dovishly naive. They've got that innocent part down pat. They're about as wise and crafty as Ned Flanders. So we should aspire to be wise, but that wisdom entails that we know in this situation, is this an indirect command or not a direct one? And I think when it comes to how to approach this, this is more of an indirect command, not a direct one. So I can't bind the conscience. I can't tell you, thou must vote, or thou must abstain, or thou must write in a third party candidate. Now, in my opinion, given the context we find ourselves in, I think it's better to vote for one of the two major parties so your vote actually means something. You're free to disagree. That's my opinion. Most of the pastors and theologians who I think actually reason well, not in that sort of Gnostic sort of way, most of them that I think reason well in political philosophy agree on this. This could change by the next election. In fact, it could change in the next month, but at least right now, based on the options before us, that seems to be the best strategy for the sake of long-term flourishing. Neither candidate perfectly represents our interests. But I think the vote for one at least leaves the door open for our interests to have a chance. I think it's kind of like playing the Would You Rather game. This is one of my daughter's favorite games. Would you rather eat a nail or step on a nail? Would you rather cut off a finger or a toe? And most of the time, the answer is neither, right? Although there was a season where my daughter was just figuring it out, where she would ask me really one horrible thing and one great thing. It's like that SNL skit where fake Harry Carey asks if you'd rather be the top scientist in your field or have mad cow disease. Most of the time, the point of the game is that both options are horrible, and you're not allowed to say neither, because them's the rules, right? Likewise, in politics, sometimes you'd rather neither candidate win, but that isn't the game. One will win. You have a limited choice in a binary system. So taking all things into account, most of the guys that I read and follow think a more compelling case can be made to play the game by voting for one of the two major parties. And when it comes to these parties, there's an argument that goes like this. It's never appropriate to vote for the lesser of two evils. I've heard that a lot. Now, I appreciate the sentiment of that, but I also think it's a bit simplistic. After all, every vote represents the choice of a lesser of two evils. Right? Take the beloved Ronald Reagan, for example. Right? He's seen today as a champion of conservative values, but he wasn't perfect. He was a former Hollywood movie star. He divorced his first wife. In fact, when he was governor of California, he signed the first ever legislation legalizing the fiction of no-fault divorce. He was softer on gun rights than he should have been. He also wasn't fully aligned with biblical values on the topic of abortion. He supported abortion in a number of cases. So he wasn't perfect, and yet are you telling me you wouldn't vote for him over Stalin or Putin or Kim Jong-un? Of course you would. Why? Because he's the better of two imperfect choices. Or, to say it another way, he's the lesser of two evils. Everyone except for Jesus is evil. Some people out of principle can't go there. Their conscience won't allow them to vote for the lesser of two evils. I think their conscience is wrong. But regardless, the Bible is clear that in matters of conscience, there is a degree of freedom. So we can perhaps agree to disagree on whether you should vote for the lesser of two evils or you should write in a vote or abstain. Those are matters of prudence and wisdom. I'm not going to bind your conscience, not sin. Those are indirect, not direct applications. But what we can't agree to disagree on is voting for the greater of two evils. There is no consistent, logical case to be made for voting for the worst candidate, the one that will most threaten shalom, peace, prosperity, human flourishing. That's a direct command. That's obvious to even common sense. A Christian can't vote for the greater of two evils. Now, it doesn't mean you're not a Christian if you vote for the greater of two evils, but it does mean that you aren't acting in a way that is consistent with a Christian worldview. Christians do a lot of evil things. legitimate, regenerate Christians have murdered, they've committed adultery, they've lied, they've stolen, all kinds of other things. But the point is that they're doing so, when they're doing so, they're betraying their faith and principles. And that's what it would be to vote for the greater of two evils. I want to close with this before we do Q&A. The church has an opportunity right now. There are millions upon millions of frustrated voters out there who are disenchanted with life, who aren't Christians, who don't go to church, who couldn't tell you the difference between Noah's Ark and the Ark of the Covenant. They just want normalcy. They just want stability. They don't want their kindergartners groomed. They don't want their middle schooler to be taken from them because he or she is confused about their identity. They don't want people who hate this country determining its direction. They don't want to be quarantined when they're perfectly healthy. They don't want to get fired for not calling a man a woman. They don't want to have to get injected with experimental drugs. They don't want inflation to prevent them from buying a home or food. They don't want to be judged on the color of their skin, but the content of their character. I think the church has an opportunity in this moment to introduce them to a standard of morality and justice that doesn't ebb and flow with the culture. In other words, we have an opportunity to introduce them to the King. I think the fields are white with harvest, with people who are just disgruntled by the chaos of our culture around us. And here's the deal. We have good news. Good news is God wins. Spurgeon says, justice may at times leave the courts of man, but it abides upon the tribunal of God. And in the end, every tongue, every tribe, every nation, every person will bow to Christ. In the end, his kingdom will come, and his will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Let's pray. Father, again, grateful for an opportunity this morning to talk about these important things. I pray, Lord, that anything that I have said that's not helpful would, like chaff, just be blown away, and that we would be nourished with the wheat of true biblical theological principles. I pray that you would continue to help us to think and act in a way that is most conducive with the precepts of your kingdom. I pray, knowing, Lord, that our ultimate hope is not in politics. Our ultimate hope is that one day your Son will return. And so we pray, Maranatha, come, Lord Jesus. We ask in Christ's name. Amen.